I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is social action activist and legend, Ted Mann. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Summer vacation has been here in southern Arizona, where I live, and while we're almost past that lovely season, many parts of this country and the greater world are still enjoying its luxurious passage. Summer vacation is a time for journeying out to see family and friends, perhaps even more importantly, to encounter new places and new experiences of every kind. For some of us, this means heading off to the beach or the mountains. For others, this was a more ambitious trip to other countries and continents. Travel is one experience that can expand your mind, and of course your waistline, and broaden your horizons. I have often discoursed here on Two Jewish on the traveling tendencies of the Jewish people from the earliest times. Abraham started it all nearly 4 millennia ago, journeying out as the very first wandering Jew. But in nearly every generation, we have had outstanding travelers. They ranged from patriarchs like Jacob and Joseph and Moses to the entire people of Israel, wanderers around the wilderness of Sinai for some 40 years. And continued onward to all the many Jewish travelers of antiquity in the Middle Ages who spread our faith and peoplehood to all the four corners of the earth. In more recent centuries, our own near ancestors traveled from these same four corners to come to America and to Israel, bringing the experiences of all of those disparate places to every new Jewish adventure. In each generation, behold or vador, we have a tendency to head out for the road, sometimes seeking freedom or opportunity, sometimes fleeing oppression, sometimes just going out to see what's around the next corner. And right now, with no better motivation than needing a break, it has been vacation time. One of the truly liberating aspects of vacations is that they serve as a kind of extended Shabbat, a cessation of our normal lives. I sometimes think that if we really took a full day off to rest up every week, we wouldn't really need vacations. If we really could manage to spend 24 hours a week doing nothing, shutting off our electronics, avoiding technology, having a real Yom Menucha, a day of true rest, wouldn't that kind of add up to the same thing as a two-week vacation once a year? Actually, wouldn't it add up to more like a 7 or 8 week vacation every year? It's just that it's so hard to break the work habit on a weekly basis. It becomes essential to have one of these more complete vacation experiences at least once a year. And so we hit the road searching for rest and relaxation, or perhaps intellectual and spiritual stimulation. What have we found out there on the holiday road? Holiday road. Holiday road. Holiday road. As the Buddhist saying has it, wherever you go, there you are. But the truth is that for some of us, the version of ourselves we discover on vacation is not just us, but a more pleasant version of ourselves. For those of you journeying onward to new and exciting places, may you be blessed within the Siyah Tova, a good and safe journey, and may you return refreshed and reinvigorated and inspired. As the blessing in the Torah has it, Seidchem l'shalom uvoachem l'shalom, go forth in peace and return in peace from your vacations. And for those of you who have now completed your journeys and are returning home for good, Bruchim Habaim, welcome back. To play us in more officially on this late July morning, here's a lovely, if schmaltzy, Israeli song, Zemer Nugeh. It's about voices calling out to each other from a great distance. Hatishma Koli, will you hear my voice when you're far away? Hatishma Koli, will you hear my voice where you're going? This country is beautiful, its ways are wide. Hear my voice.
Hatishma Koli, Rechoki Sheli. Hatishma Koli, Bahasher Hincha.
That was Zemer Nugeh, a sad song based on the poet Rachel's gorgeous little lyric set by Shmulik Kraus. It's also called Hatishma Koli, an Israeli song about calling out across the distance to those we love, whether we are returning from a vacation or just calling across the hall. As we reach out to you this morning, when we come back on Too Jewish, we'll meet our guest, the remarkable social activist Ted Mann, who has made a difference with his life nearly every day. Find out about Tikkun Olam from him, how and why, when we return this morning on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all new body style. It looks absolutely great. It's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a vent price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Craig difference.
We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. He's Ted Mann, a really powerful and important advocate for Tikkun Olam, social justice, written a book called If I'm Only for Myself, obviously based on the quote from Pirkei Avot, has received many awards for his work for, I think social justice is the right term, maybe you could call it religious action. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
I'm glad to be on.
Tell us what motivated you to get involved in social action, social justice work, initially.
Oh, my. Now you're going back a very long time. But I suppose it was my Jewish education. I had been sent to an Orthodox yeshiva in New York, which I ran away from, and came to believe that what being Jewish meant is social action. and I was going to spend my life doing it, and I have.
Now, you had a day job, too. Tell me how you... You're
yeah.
an attorney.
I was a trial lawyer in complex commercial litigation such as antitrust law and securities fraud. That's how I made my living. And as part of that, I spent a very large part of my time as a lawyer handling and starting cases that involved social justice on behalf of Jewish organizations or on behalf of the ACLU, like the Bible reading case that happened in 19, God knows when, it was a long time ago in Abington Township, mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, and the Sunday Blue Laws cases, and thereafter for the rest of my life, maybe 20 or 30 other cases involving mostly the First Amendment, the religious freedom clauses, and free speech.
Free speech seems like such a natural cause for Jews. We talk too much anyway.
Yes.
Tell us the most interesting free speech case you were involved in.
That's a tough... Now you're yanking at my memory. I am 85 years old.
Kinahara.
And every month I remember less. So, if during the course of this conversation one of such cases comes to mind, I'll mention it
All
to
right,
you.
Fair enough. We will talk much more with Ted Mann when we come back on Too Jewish about social action, social justice, and why it is sort of the foundation of his Judaism and how it can be a big part of yours when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com, T-O-O, Jewish Radio. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. In this season of heat and light, here's a lovely, cool song from Achinoam Nini, the wonderful Israeli-American singer Noah. It's called Life is Beautiful.
Smile without a reason why. Love as if you were a child. Smile no matter what they tell you. Don't listen to a word they say, 'cause life is beautiful that way. Tears, a tidal wave of tears. Light that slowly disappears. Wait before you close the curtain. There's still another game to play, and life is beautiful that way. Is real and what we dream. name is love alone. Keep the laughter in your eyes. Soon your long-awaited beautiful that way.
That was the Israeli-American singer Noah singing her wonderful song, Life is Beautiful, a lyric set to the theme song from that wonderful Oscar-winning film of the same name, Life is Beautiful, made some 16 years ago. Hard to believe it's been that long. Time is beginning to fly more quickly, I suppose. The Yoren Fliegen, they say in Yiddish. The years fly by. Well, as long as we are in a philosophical mood, it's time now for a randomly recurring feature of Too Jewish, our Zen Judaism segment. This morning, haikus for Jews. No egg and no cream, just syrup, seltzer, and milk. The Zen of the egg cream. And our second haiku for Jews. Like a bonsai tree, your terrible posture at my dinner table. Those were haikus for Jews, a couple of koans of Zen Judaism. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, after 3 years here. Boker Tov, Guy, good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So have your perceptions about Zionism changed at all over the time you were representing Israel in America, living here, being a shliach, a representative of Israel in the United States?
You know, Zionism always had different various and different elements in my eyes. One of the biggest question is, can you be a Zionist and not live in Israel? Can you be an American Zionist? Now, for many years, Israelis and some significant Israeli leaders, including the late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, basically said, no, you can't. You know, if you're a Zionist, make Aliyah, come and live in Israel, be part of the dream. After leaving here, I can say that the question is more complicated. And maybe you can be a Zionist here. Not the same type of Zionist, but you can be a support. You can support Israel. You can relate to Israel. You can have Israel as a significant part of your Jewish identity, something deep in your heart, and be a true Zionist. Have my Zionism changed? I guess it did, you know, maybe shifted a little bit to the direction of Echad Ha'am concept of Zionism, Zionism that sees Israel as the heart and soul of the Jewish people, but not necessarily as the only place Jews should ever be. It's a tricky question. It's a tricky question.
You know, it's interesting. I worked with a guy who really liked Echad Ha'am, and he used to see it as sort of a solar system with different planets, you know, and the other planets were the other Jewish communities. It wasn't as though everything had to be on the sun. And if Israel was the sun, then the light was shining elsewhere, but some light also came off of the others. It's a little bit patronizing, but not nearly as bad as saying if you don't live in Israel, you're not living a Jewish life.
True. True, and yet, you know, I think the biggest question for the Jewish people in general is how would the Jewish people be in 100 years, and whether or not there will be Jewish life in Israel at that time, and how will they look like, and whether or not there will be Jewish life in the United States or in other diasporas in 100 years, and how will they look like. It goes back to a conversation we had a while back about the boundaries of Jewish identity and the glue that keeps us together. Can you be a Jew without being a member of a community, of a Jewish community? Can you be a Jew without a connection to the Jewish land, to the Jewish homeland, to Israel, to the Hebrew bookshelf? When do you stop being Jewish?
Yeah.
When have you crossed the border, you know?
It's a great question, and one that we continue to answer, and we'll continue to answer every day. Thank you, Guy.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about, I know this is a shock, everybody, the Middle East, Egypt and Turkey. Let's talk a little bit about the so-called revolution in Turkey, which differs from the Egyptian one in which, it certainly seems like a very fluid situation. In Turkey, it was kind of unexpected.
Right. Well, in Turkey, the prime minister is on his second term. Erdogan is widely perceived as being sort of an Islamist or fundamentalist or whatever. And surprisingly for many outside observers, a lot of the people protesting most vigorously are Islamists. In fact, it's not secularists versus Islamists. It's not young people versus old. A lot of sort of people in their 40s and 50s who are dissatisfied with the high-handedness of the administration, which is actually a long tradition left over from Ottoman days of bureaucrats and people who work for the government acting like pashas, acting sort of unapproachable, not responsive, not being tuned in to the people's wishes. And Erdogan, in some ways, personifies this. His response to these demonstrators, who could have been placated relatively easily at the beginning, was so high-handed, and he called them like looters and vandals, although they didn't vandalize anything, and they certainly didn't loot anything, that they started cartoons caricaturing him, and the most popular song in Turkey became "We Are the Looters," making fun of him, because basically people want to take him and, by extension, government bureaucrats down a notch, and they want an administrative style that seems to be more responsive to their aspirations, whether those aspirations are religious or secularist, whether they're modernist or traditional, whether they're urban or rural, doesn't matter. They want to see a government which is more responsive. They also have a preoccupation almost to the point of an obsession with whoever is the leader of Turkey, the elected leader of Turkey, being manipulated by outside powers. And this is typical of the region. The Balkans are very much like this. They're sort of outside powers are always held to blame. Nobody ever dies a natural death. There's always witchcraft or assassination or poisonings or whatever. And the problem in Turkey is that Turkey has been a really good member of the international community. It's been a good member of NATO. It was for a while an active candidate for membership in the European Union. It has reached out and embraced an internationalist role, which some people denigrate as being neo-Ottoman. Actually, I think it's praiseworthy to try to be a good citizen of your neighborhood, especially a neighborhood as explosive, as difficult, and as marked by a sensitive past as the neighborhood in which Turkey finds itself. It's interesting that both the states we're talking about, Turkey and Israel, were in the forefront of the Islamic states that had
Turkey and Egypt,
that at least at one point both had extremely good relationships with Israel.
Right.
They've been uneven. They've been called into question. The relationship between Israel and Turkey is once again on the upswing. The relationship between Israel and Egypt is impossible to describe right now because who knows what Egypt is right now from one day to the next, 1 week to the next. But it's interesting that the two countries we're talking about are both leaders in the region and leaders in terms of setting a new tone for relationships between Islamic countries and Israel.
It'd be very interesting. We'll continue to follow this. Thanks so much, Tom. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The nice Jewish mother-in-law comes home and finds her own son-in-law, Eli, furious and packing a suitcase. "What happened, Eli?" she asks. And he screamed, "What happened? I'll tell you what happened. I sent an email to my wife saying I was coming home from the trip today. I get home, and what do I find? My wife, yes, my Rachel, your daughter, with a naked guy in our marital bed. This is the end of our marriage. I will leave forever." "Calm down, Eli," says the mother-in-law. "There's something odd about this. Rachel wouldn't do such a thing. Wait, I'll check what happened." Moments later, the mother-in-law emerges from the bedroom with a big smile. "You see, I said there had to be a simple explanation. Rachel never got your email." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and read your email. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Re'ei, the fourth Sedra in the book of Deuteronomy, which follows a sequence of magnificent Torah portions with yet another remarkable text. Re'ei includes one of the most radical statements in the whole of Torah. Ki yevecha evyon me'achad achecha be'achad sharecha. If there is among you a poor man, one of your brothers, within one of your gates, in the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand from your needy brother. Ki fatoach tiftach et yadecha lo. You shall certainly open your hand to him. Give him enough of whatever he lacks, whatever he wants. This commandment is not simply to provide for the needs of the needy, not just to alleviate their suffering, but to give them what they actually want: sustenance, security, a decent life. It is much more than we seek to provide in our American society, in which the safety net seemingly has as many holes as net. It is more than the social protesters in Israel the last couple of years believed that their own society was providing. It is a powerful, dramatic statement. Open your hand and surely give the needy poor what they ought to have. This is part of the strong economic agenda of Deuteronomy. No one is supposed to accumulate great wealth or enormous power. No one is to be left destitute. Most importantly, our moral obligation is to see to it that none of our brothers and sisters is left without what they need in order to survive. Herein lies a foundational lesson on the morality of giving. Give not only what someone needs in your opinion, give her or him enough to live reasonably and with dignity, and do so in a way that preserves the recipient's dignity. That is the true measure of tzedakah, of living justly and in righteousness. Judaism is at heart pragmatic ethics. We are trained to make the world morally better by practical action. After exploring the Talmudic dictum that even those who receive charity need to give something to those with even less, the rabbis concluded that tzedakah is meant to be a percentage of your income, not a hard figure, and that the same percentage, whether it's 10% or 5% of gross income or another number, should be given in good times and bad. It's true that when there is less income, there will be a smaller absolute amount donated, but the percentage, and thus the integrity of individual morality, must be preserved. Over the more than 18 years that I have been a rabbi, and the 17 years before that when I served as a cantor, I have seen good economic times, terrible economic times and plenty of in-between economic times, but I have never seen a time when there wasn't great importance for tzedakah to help those in need, because there are always people in need. So open your hand and give a percentage of your gross income to help others. Do so freely and generously in good times, in tough times, at all times. It's the Jewish thing to do. It's the right thing to do. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Ted Mann, will explain what motivated and motivates him to try to change the world and why it should matter to you too. Find out about some of the great causes he's been involved in and what he did when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary. In Jewish baseball news, the Hebrew Hammer has been shelved for the rest of the season, and it's because he's accused of using performance-enhancing drugs. Milwaukee Brewers star slugger Ryan Braun, just a year and a half removed from winning the Most Valuable Player award for his outstanding play, has agreed to a suspension for the rest of the baseball season after being linked yet again to the purchase and very likely use of human growth hormone and perhaps other PEDs. Braun, the outstanding left fielder who hits for power and average and steals bases, managed to get off his last brush for using banned performance drugs when his test sample was mishandled a year and a half ago. But this time, the best lawyers couldn't get him a get-out-of-jail-free card for his continued dalliance with the magic pills and serums that seemed to turn good baseball players into superstars. In many ways, Ryan Braun has been a poster child for Jewish ballplayers, leading a wave of outstanding stars that make this the golden age of Jewish baseball. Braun has been the most accomplished of a group that includes Ian Kinsler, Jason Marquis, Ike Davis, and the rest of a fine group who've been all-stars and have appeared in the World Series. But this latest revelation taints Braun's reputation in ways no Jewish player has ever before been tarnished. While no one is suggesting excommunication for PEDs, it's very hard to see him ever again being a role model for Jewish kids, no matter how many home runs he eventually hits. What a shame. In Israel, the horse race for chief rabbi is over, and after a close contest that actually looked for a while like it might change the unfortunate status quo for that high but highly publicized office, the eventual decision was for more of the same. Rabbis David Lau and Yitzhak Yosef, both sons of former Israeli chief rabbis, were elected as Ashkenazi and Sephardi chief rabbi of Israel, respectively. Last week's vote by Knesset members, local officials, and regional rabbis was the culmination of a tense, months-long campaign with an unusually high public profile. Both terms are for 10 years. Lau, who won 68 votes in the three-candidate race, is the son of former chief rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, actually a fine chief rabbi. Like his father, who served from 1993 to 2003, Lau hopes to serve as a bridge between Israel's modern Orthodox and Haredi Orthodox communities. He's currently chief rabbi of the fastest-growing central city of Modin. Rabbi Yitzhak Yosef is the son of Rabbi Ovadiah Yosef, the spiritual leader of the Sephardi Orthodox Shah's party, who held the post from 1973 to 1983. The head of the Hazon Avadiah Yeshiva in Jerusalem, which was founded by and named for his father, he picked up 68 votes to defeat three candidates. Next was Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu with 49. His win is seen as a victory for the Sephardic political party Shas, which the elder Yosef founded soon after his chief rabbi term ended. On the Ashkenazi side, Rabbi Lau staved off the challenge of a runner-up, Rabbi David Stav, a reforming candidate who gained widespread support from secular Israelis with his pledges to streamline the rabbinate bureaucracy. Stav, who garnered 54 votes, also was the preferred candidate of several political parties, including the centrist Yesh Atid, the hardline Yisrael Beiteinu, and the nationalist Jewish Home parties. Because Stav made this a surprisingly close race, perhaps we can expect some reforming of the chief rabbinate, or at least a moderating influence in its increasingly strident and often reactionary response to any changes at all in Israeli religious life. In sad news, the longtime executive director of New York's 92nd Street Y, Saul Adler, was fired after revelations that he'd had a long-term affair with his assistant. Adler had an extramarital affair with Catherine Marteau, the Manhattan Jewish Community Center's liaison for board and donor relations. Marteau also was fired after the Y deemed that she provided unsatisfactory answers to an investigation of her son-in-law, Sal Tadeo, a former Y employee who allegedly received kickbacks from Y vendors while working there. Adler had served as executive director of the Y since 1988 and had started working there in 1978. Deputy Executive Director Henry Timms will take over for Adler while the Y searches for a replacement. Poland's Jewish community plans to petition the country's constitutional court in an effort to strike down the legislature's decision to forbid kosher slaughter, Poland's Chief Rabbi Michael Szydrik said last week after meeting with Polish Religious Affairs Minister Michael Bani. The ongoing effort by the Polish legislature and administration to ban shuchita has the Jewish communities of Europe outraged and evokes memories of the beginnings of Nazi persecutions. We'll continue to follow this story and hope that outside pressure will reverse this effort as it has in other countries that have tried to ban kosher food. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. He's Ted Mann, one of the most prominent and interesting activists on behalf of social action and social justice. He was a trial lawyer initially and found that his work and his avocation came together at many times. But in particular, he's been motivated to pursue creating a better world to follow the principle of Tikkun Olam. He has a book called If I'm Only for Myself, really kind of a memoir, both personal stories and also his own ideals as to how we should live our lives in terms of interacting with social justice. Ted, early in the show you said that really the formation of your Jewish identity came from the concept of Tikkun Olam. Can you amplify that a little bit?
What I had said was that my parents had sent me to an Orthodox yeshiva in Brooklyn. We lived in Connecticut at the time. And I couldn't stand it. And it wasn't for me. And I ran away from it in the middle of my second year. And over the years, I came to think that that's not what being Jewish should be. It ought to be helping create a better world. Now, mind you, at that time, it was in the middle of the Second World War. I remember feeling, even then, something in my guts. When I would see a headline calling the Japanese Japs or Nips, which is what the headlines were doing in 1942 and 1943,
sure,
the period I'm talking about.
During World War II.
It would really bother me. Even the Japanese, I thought, are entitled to respect for who they are. And it offended me. Needless to say, the anti-Semitism that I ran into in those years likewise offended me even more. And that's how I decided to use my law profession, which I did, to institute cases and to file amicus briefs with the court in First Amendment issues.
When you started on this, and that couldn't have been a popular approach in that period.
No, it couldn't, but I wasn't, I was 14 or 15 at the time.
Right.
I wasn't starting lawsuits. I hadn't gone to college yet. But I'm giving you the background of,
sure, I understand,
what kind of person I was offended even then.
Even then.
And when, right, I became a lawyer, it was an opportunity to do more than make a living at the practice of law and to try to help people that needed help in the way I was taught in law school.
Things have gone various directions in terms of the public display of religion in America. Talk a little bit about that issue.
The public display of religion, I find, has usually been pushed by those who are ready to violate the First Amendment's Freedom of Religion Clause. Ronald Reagan was the president who felt that those of us who were in favor of separation of church and state and to be strictly construed were opposed to religion. And every time they would do something that was particularly unjust, I would notice that at the same time, the Reagan administration would come out in favor of public displays of religion that I thought were really quite hypocritical.
And in that, you know, for a long time, Jews, I think, were very, well, hard to say anything unanimous about Jews, but much of the opinion in the Jewish community was against public display of religion. Now, I think it's begun to waver. What do you think of that?
Waver, I don't think is, I'm not sure I agree with you.
Okay.
I think proper public displays of religion, such as at Christmas time, putting a wreath on your door and singing songs that go back to the creation of the Western canon of music, I think are proper. But reading the Bible in the public school, I think, is highly improper. And that's why I started that lawsuit back in the, oh God, when was it? In the 1950s, yes, in the 1950s, that resulted in the Supreme Court of the United States outlawing the reading of the Bible in the public schools and laws that required it. It was required in virtually every state.
Right.
I want to explore an old issue that people have, I think, substantially forgotten now, the whole question of Soviet Jewry, which you were intimately involved with. Can you tell us how you got involved and how it worked for your perspective?
Well, I think it's probably the most important thing that the American Jewish community, as a community, has done in my lifetime, is the part they played together with the part Israel played in freeing the Jews of the Soviet Union. It was a remarkable success story. It's too long a story to begin to tell it, and I think most of your audience
knows basics,
the story.
Right. Of course.
But that it worked out so perfectly, ultimately. I remember in 1987, when I would make speeches around the country saying the way, if the settlements in the West Bank continue, and if there isn't a peace, then by the time your child that is born today gets bar mitzvahed in the year 2000, there will no longer be any place in the world where a majority of the population is Jewish. And that would have been true, by the way, because the Palestinians were growing at a much more rapid pace. And then suddenly, beginning in 1987 and 8, well, you know the story, more than a million Jews came to Israel. Another 300,000 came to America.
Right.
And I won't say that solved the problem that I was then concerned with, which was the settlements that were making peace impossible. But it certainly delayed for a very long time the concern that there's going to be no place in the world where there is a country that has a majority of Jews.
You were president of both the JCPA and the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. I cannot think of a more difficult task than to be the president of a group of presidents, by the way. Especially Jewish ones.
Actually, it was the most exciting 2 years of my life. Being the chairman of the Conference of Presidents doesn't mean a hell of a lot most of the time. But in 1978 to 1980, when I was its chairman, that's when the peace treaty with Egypt was being developed.
Exactly, the whole Camp David process.
The whole Camp David thing began then,
yep,
and ended successfully before my term was over.
Yeah, I was going to give you credit for it, actually.
I'll take it.
You know, Ted, I was going to say, what a remarkable time, because I think Sadat went to Israel just before you took over the presidency. What was the role of the conference in that period? It was a delicate time. Carter was not particularly popular with the Jewish community already by then, all because, really, of the issue of Israel. Tell us a little bit about your role in that.
Yes, the issue of Israel, and we argued mightily with President Carter, because making peace with Egypt wasn't enough for him. He wanted also to make peace really all over the world. He really had a vision of himself as doing this, and he wanted to make peace with the Palestinians at the same time. Now, needless to say, our community, our Jewish community in America, not to mention Israel, had very strong views about peace with Egypt, yes, but peace with the Palestinians, we were divided as we are divided today. And President Carter tried very hard, but ultimately realized that peace with Egypt in and of itself is a great accomplishment, and it really was. It's been 33 years now since we've had peace with Egypt. I don't know, and you don't know, what's going to happen in the next year or two.
Well, I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen in Egypt in the next year or two.
That's right, but I suspect the peace will hold on. I think that everybody that's relevant to the situation, America and the various parties in Egypt as well as Israel, really don't want that to change. And it's been a wonderful accomplishment. I only wish we had gone, not at the time, but I at the time, I was urging President Carter to leave the Palestinian issue alone, because he's not going to get peace with Egypt if he keeps pushing it. That was essentially my role. But now it would be a wonderful thing if we could get a peace process started with the Palestinians. It wouldn't jeopardize anything in terms of our peace treaty with Egypt. And it might mean that there will be an Israel for as long as we are living, at least through the end of the century. It would be a phenomenal accomplishment. But I've got nothing to do with that now. I'm just an old man looking back on old times.
Some very interesting times indeed, and your book shows some of that. You know, I always wondered why the peace treaty with Egypt happened so, you know, so dramatic, so important, and the peace treaties with Jordan took a lot longer, had to follow the Oslo process, even though on the surface, Israel's relationship with Jordan was much closer and much healthier than its relationship with Egypt.
All right. I think the Israel was in fact at peace, if not legally,
right,
with Jordan ever since 1970.
Right. Since they helped with sort of Black September expelling
right,
the Palestinians.
But there's no way that Jordan could have been the first country to make peace with Israel and survive. Jordan was very weak, and it's got, as the current president or prime minister of Jordan said fairly recently, we're stuck behind a rock and a hard place, meaning Iraq and Israel. And it's got Syria on one side, Iraq on the other side, etc. It could not make peace, a formal peace with Israel, and survive. But once Egypt did it, then it began to become possible. And ultimately, 1994, it happened. But they had been truly friends, the Jordanian country and its current president as well, the son, truly good friends of Israel, and they've been helping each other out for a long time.
Ted,
that's a real peace.
Yeah, I think it is, and it has been, in many ways, a much warmer peace than with Egypt.
Oh, yeah, and it doesn't depend on America giving Egypt $2 billion and Israel $2 billion every year.
Right, just to keep the peace, as it were.
Right, absolutely.
One of the challenges for those of us who care about a lot of different causes, who are active in social action and religious action, is deciding what's the most important thing. You know, what are your priorities? Because there are so many good causes and so many important acts, and that's obviously a Jewish approach. Tell us what you think, from your remarkable perspective, is the most important issue facing American Jews today.
Well, in terms of Tikkun Olam, in terms of
yes,
making this a better world, I think you have to start with just feeding people that aren't being fed. I think hunger in America, because here we are, and here's where we might be able to do something about it because of our political clout. Hunger in America, but hunger all over the world, I think, is a Jewish issue, and we've got to do something about it, and that's where we should be putting much of our money. What else? Peace, of course. Peace for us in the Middle East, of course. God knows whether it's ever going to happen, but I think we have to keep struggling for it, and we have to be urging Israel, I think, to be as welcoming as possible to the notion of peace with the Palestinians. That hasn't been happening, I need hardly tell you, for a very long time.
It's been a while.
And there are a lot of American Jewish organizations who are in the business of solving that problem, who responsibly criticize Israel in ways that do not hurt Israel, and at least four or five such organizations, from J Street to Americans for Peace Now, to I can't even think of them, but there's at least five that one can join in order to urge Israel responsibly to do what it should be doing in terms of the peace process. But I'd still put hunger first.
It's not a bad place. You know, it seems like it should be a Jewish cause, and it is, because food matters for us.
In many ways.
In many ways. I want to thank Ted Mann for a great visit here on Too Jewish. I feel like we've only just barely scratched the surface of his extraordinary career. His book is called If I Am Only for Myself, obviously taken from Pirkei Avot. Im Ein Ani Li Mili. Ted, thank you for a great visit and for your extraordinary career and your remarkable dedication to Tikkun Olam, to social justice.
Thank you very, very much for inviting me on your program.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guests and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in Southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best.
To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Max Brooks, author of World War Z, now a very popular and major motion picture, and a variety of other Jewish zombie books. And oh, by the way, he's also the son of Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft. Our playout this morning comes from Ella Jebelin, singing the Idan Reichel Project song, Im Telech. If you leave, who will hold me like this? Who will hear me at the end of the day? Who will soothe and comfort me? Only you know how. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Mi shmalti besof hayom.